This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars episode number 28 was recorded on July 8th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. All-Star Louis Vincent Gav is back with us today. Louis, it's great to talk to you again. Here we are, well, not quite all-time highs today, but just a couple of sessions ago, we went above 3,000 on the S&P. New all-time highs. The bulls are screaming. This can only mean one thing, which is everything is great in the economy. Nothing's wrong. What's to worry about higher from here? But hang on a second. We got $13.5 trillion of negative yielding sovereign debt around the world. And although the bond market is not quite at an all-time high, it's awfully high. It doesn't really jibe with what we would normally expect when we see the stock market breaking out to new all-time highs. What's going on here? What does it mean? And what can we expect?
Well, thanks a lot for having me again, Eric. It's always a pleasure to catch up. I think first to highlight, of course, U.S. stocks are at all-time highs. If you look at the world MSCI ex-U.S., we're nowhere near all-time highs. We made our highs in January 2018, and we're a good 10% below that, having gone as far as 23% below that. So yes, U.S. equities are at all-time high, and frankly, the valuation gap between U.S. equities and the rest of the world is not at all-time highs because we had higher highs in 99, but it's pretty darn high. So that's a first caveat. And look, I think what we have today in the markets is a sort of odd paradigm where, indeed, with $13.5 trillion in negative yielding debt, with an entire German curve, an entire Swiss curve, an entire French curve, an entire Japanese curve, all in negative territory, you're in an environment where investors are basically inherently making a bet that global growth is, in essence, going to stay mediocre. It's not going to be terrible, otherwise stocks would obviously be much lower, but it's not going to be that great. And with that, you're going to be in an investment environment with very modest inflation. In other words, people are taking the environment of the recent years and projecting that not just for the next 6 months, but projecting it for the next 10 years. And, you know, I think there's a fair amount of recency bias here going on. And the problem with recency bias is it can push you into strategies that perhaps if you take a step back, may not make that much sense. Let's take today what's happening as an example. I think because of this view that global growth is mediocre and inflation will stay modest forever, investors today are going out and buying overvalued tech stocks as fast as they can. So you'll pay up for Amazon, you'll pay up for Salesforce.com, you'll pay up for anything that for Adobe, you'll pay up for Microsoft. We'll just pay up for anything that delivers growth. And that's fine. But then investors fear that, hold on, I've paid up to get growth here. What if growth doesn't show up? What if really we have another hit to the system because China implodes, because Europe implodes, because the U.S. consumer tightens the belt or whatever the reason? What happens if growth disappoints? I need to have some growth cushions in my portfolio. And so investors turn around and pay up for bonds, the negative yield that we talked about. They pay up for bond proxies, i.e. utilities, staples, and so forth. So in essence, investors end up with what I've started to call a dumbbell portfolio, where you bought overvalued stocks, i.e. technology, but you hedge those by buying overvalued bonds and overvalued utilities. So you end up with this dumbbell portfolio of two overvalued sets of assets that are inherently both dependent on inflation never showing up and on growth staying very mediocre. If either of these things turn out not to be true, you end up getting crushed on both sides.
Louis, you started your last answer by saying, okay, the U.S., it may be at new all-time highs, but the rest of the world sure isn't. And that really resonates for me. And it makes me think to this thesis that I've heard from at least one or two other guests that we have saying, look, what's going on here is normally for the rest of the world when things get crappy. The safety trade for them is into their own sovereign bonds, in their country's sovereign bonds, because that's what you do when you're trying to rotate out of the stock market. In a situation where you've got all this negative yielding debt around the world, what they're doing is they're rotating into U.S. stocks, and that's what's holding U.S. stocks up. And at least one guest, Brent Johnson, is saying it's going to continue because things are going to get a lot worse, and he thinks that's going to drive stocks higher. I thought it was crazy the first time Brent said that, but boy, look at what the tape is showing us. The equity sell-off for the whole rest of the world is very real. It started more than a year ago. But look at the U.S. stock market. Do you have any other explanation or any thoughts on that explanation as to whether that could be what's in play here?
I think that's one possible explanation, but I think, in fairness, many others. The first, of course, is the composition of indices. When you look at the U.S. index, something clearly sets it apart from almost any other benchmark in the world, and that is the weight of the technology sector. And here, you know, I think we must acknowledge that a big part of the U.S. outperformance has come from the likes of the Amazons, the Microsofts, the Adobes of this world. This has really been what has driven U.S. outperformance. If you look at, you know, stock benchmarks in Europe and Japan or other places, you typically have benchmarks that are very often dominated by financials. Now, clearly, in an environment of negative yield curves or negative yields across the yield curve, that's a very tough environment for banks to make money in. And in that respect, I think what we're seeing right now with Deutsche Bank is sort of a caricature of what's unfolding with banks everywhere, which is that usually when you get a financial crisis, the response of central banks is to collapse interest rates, have a steep yield curve, and then the banks can sort of recapitalize themselves on the steep yield curve over time. The problem today, of course, is we've reached such low levels of yield that this is no longer possible. It's definitely no longer possible in Europe. It's no longer possible in Japan. And so you collapse the yields today, but what does it do? It actually ends up killing the very banks that you were hoping to save. So I think that's an important shift in the environment, which perhaps helps explain why we've got a lot of these other countries underperforming.
Louis, let's stay on Deutsche Bank. There are some people now suggesting, hey, this is it. This is the Lehman moment. Deutsche Bank is the new Lehman. What we're seeing happening with Deutsche Bank right here, right now, is the beginning of something that's about to happen to the entire banking sector. It's time to panic. Other people are saying, that's crazy. Deutsche Bank has just screwed up a few things, and it's unique to their situation. What's the real bottom line here?
I don't think it's a Lehman moment. I don't think it's a Lehman moment. For a very simple reason, and that is that Lehman was a crisis because all of a sudden you had to unwind a bunch of counterparty risks, and you didn't know who owned what, and nobody trusted each other in the financial system anymore. As Deutsche Bank goes is basically to, you know, pull back onto its domestic market, it is not defaulting on its counterparties. It is not defaulting on all the derivatives that it has written over the years. What it is doing is basically shrinking the size of the bank without defaulting. Not only that, but I think what after Lehman, it seems very unlikely that another Western government would allow a bank to, in essence, default on its counterparties and trigger the sort of chain reactions that we saw after Lehman. And so I don't think it's a Lehman moment. However, I think it is nonetheless an important moment. It's not like a Lehman crisis, but what Deutsche Bank is showing us is the limits of the negative interest rate policies, the limits of the zero interest rate policies. You know, with the negative interest rates, with the zero interest rates policy, we thought we'd found the magic money tree. We thought we'd found, you know, the ability to just create wealth out of thin air. Turns out it isn't. Turns out that the negative interest rate policy, in essence, bankrupts savings institutions. It bankrupts pension funds. It bankrupts insurance companies. And it bankrupts banks. What you are doing with the negative interest rate policies, with the zero interest rate policies, is in essence transforming the years of equity accumulation in the financial sector and transferring those either into the balance sheets of consumers or into the balance sheets of the governments. But today what we are seeing with Deutsche Bank is very clear cost of the negative interest rate policies. And that clear cost is bankruptcies of financial institutions that are hundreds of years old.
The Fed recently adjusted its terminology and stopped talking about the zero lower bound and instead is now using the phrase effective lower bound. Danielle DiMartino Booth thinks that that is a conscious and intentional plan that they're making to enable a policy of negative interest rates. She thinks they're headed toward negative interest rates and they're already planning to get there. Do you think there's any truth to that? And given all the things that you've just said, it seems like that would be a really, really bad setup for the entire financial system and particularly pensions and other savings institutions.
So I listened to Danielle's podcast with a lot of interest. And my takeaway from this is I don't think the Fed is heading there right now, but I think the Fed is thinking, well, why not give ourselves extra tools? Why not put this in the proverbial monetary policy cupboard? I think if you go back 6 months ago, 12 months ago, the view of the Fed was, let's keep rising interest rates to build up ammunition in the cupboard that we can use in a downturn, right? I mean, 6 months ago, 12 months ago, that was broadly the line given, was we need to straighten out monetary policy today so that we have ammunition in the cupboard. Very clearly, they're done putting ammunition in the cupboard. It's very politically, it's very challenging for them to hike anymore. So then they have to find other ways to put ammunition in the cupboard. And perhaps this change of language is one such way, basically opening the possibility of very different type of policy going forward. But I don't think we're about to see it. I think it's just about putting ammunition in the cupboard.
Louis, obviously, Hong Kong, where you and I both have legal residency, is a place that has been in the news a lot. And it's looking more and more to me like this whole 2047 treaty thing is a dead letter. It seems to me that China is working to effectively, even if they don't admit that that's what's happening, they're working to effectively annex Hong Kong and pull it into the Chinese legal system. First of all, do you agree or am I exaggerating to think that? Maybe I'm just being paranoid. But if so, what would that mean for the Hong Kong real estate market? Because my understanding of Hong Kong real estate is it's entirely about people getting money out of China. If it's not out anymore because it really is legally part of China, then that whole dynamic of money flowing out of the mainland into Hong Kong should stop or even reverse. What do you think?
First, I would say that it's not because you're paranoid that people aren't out to get you. So, you know, I think when it comes to Hong Kong, you're probably right to be paranoid. Look, Hong Kong's biggest comparative advantage is its independent justice system. And you're absolutely right that if it has the same justice system as China, then that makes Hong Kong a much less attractive place. Now, with that in mind, I actually found that everything that's happened in the past few weeks is decently bullish for Hong Kong rather than bearish. Because if you go back through the timeline, a few months ago, when basically Carrie Lam started to propose this extradition rule, you only had a few thousand students protesting. And, you know, a few thousand students who barely weren't going to move the needle. Fast forward a couple months, and you've got 2 million people in the streets basically demanding that Hong Kong maintain its judicial independence. I think this has raised the stakes considerably. It now makes it very hard for China to turn around and take away Hong Kong's independent justice system. Whatever they try to do to compromise Hong Kong's justice system, we'll now see 2 million people in the street again. So I think a red line has been drawn here that is going to be very hard for China to push past. And instead, my guess is over the coming years, China will most likely stay well clear of that red line. Now, when it comes to Hong Kong real estate, I would say that as long as Hong Kong's justice system remains independent, indeed, Hong Kong's real estate should be broadly doing okay. Now, granted, Hong Kong's real estate market is super high today. It's very expensive relative to income. It's very expensive relative to anywhere else in the world. I mean, it's just crazy price. So, you know, it's hard to see it go up much from here, especially if you project yourself to 2047 and beyond. And, you know, real estate is as long dated an asset class as there is. So I think that has to be one concern. Perhaps, though, we have to remember that, you know, Hong Kong real estate prices does fall and fall hard when it does. But usually Hong Kong real estate price falls come around at a time of tightening monetary policies in China and tightening monetary policies in the U.S., which, of course, is what we had in 97. And we saw Hong Kong real estate prices go down 70%. Today, we have easing of policies in China, and more importantly, we have the Fed most likely done with its tightening cycle. And so I'm not a huge bull on Hong Kong real estate because it's because of the value, but it's hard to see it collapse either. And instead, what seems more likely is that all these political tensions that we've seen in recent months allow Hong Kong to basically preserve its judicial independence and thus really preserve its comparative advantage.
Louis, before I let you go, you are the co-founder of GavCal, one of the most respected institutional research organizations in the entire marketplace. Please tell our institutional listeners where they can find out more. And for our retail audience, please let them know where they can follow your work if they can't qualify for the institutional products.
Yeah, absolutely. The best thing is to go to our website, which is gavcal.com, GavKal.com, and you can get free trials there to our research. For retail investors, we'll publish books fairly regularly. I recently published one. All our books are available on Amazon. And then finally, we have a private wealth business based out of Bellevue that publishes a blog, and that's called Evergreen GavCal. And there's a blog there, and we put up some of our research pieces through that website. So that's not a bad place as well to go get some of our stuff.
Well, Louis, thanks for the update. We look forward to having you on in another month or so. And listeners, we've got a really jam-packed week for you this week. We've got more All-Stars appearances featuring Julian Brigden, Luke Groman, and Brent Johnson. We've also got Inside the Investment Committee coming up this week, featuring Julia DeClercq, Alex Gurevich, and Julian Brigden. And we've also got Jesse Felder appearing on Macro Voices on Thursday night for our feature interview, not to mention another Energy Week episode this week. So stay tuned to your Macro Voices feed for more exciting content coming your way. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.